The Fan on Demand.
A couple of minutes after 8 o'clock on this Sunday morning. And a very good morning to you. My name is David Grossman. I'll be here for the next few hours, and this is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Every week at this time, we try to bring you a snapshot of some interesting stories in amateur sport. And people keep telling me there is a problem in the city. Not enough of it. Not enough amateur sport. Or the athletes, in many cases, who might be international professional stars of tomorrow. And I agree with them. I was at a college game on Friday night. 25 spectators. 25. And yesterday, I dropped by a university game just to see what was going on. Some good action on the ice. Again, very few fans. High school games. A handful of people show up. There were more fans at a hockey game for seven-year-olds yesterday. Seven-year-olds. So people, and I throw this out to all of you, those living on campus, staff, faculty, alumni, I guess parents, friends, you can add to that list. Are you supporting amateur sport in this city? Because it certainly doesn't look like it. And I wonder if things are any different in the sport of curling, because we're going to find out. Start off the show, a former high-performance coach, now the head honcho, bringing back curling. From AWOL, the relaunching of a program at Toronto's Humber College that's been frozen for many, many years. Great to have Cindy Bishop on the telephone with us. Good morning, Cindy. How are you?
Good morning, David. I'm fine. How are you?
Well, I'm a little ticked off. I keep hearing all these people. They send email and they tweet a lot about how the media aren't supporting amateur sport. Well, the folks aren't supporting amateur sport. This is year after year after year. I sort of wonder, do people support curling at the amateur level?
I think that the families of the athletes support it. It's all about getting the sport into the grassroots, into the curling clubs. And I think that certain associations do a good job. And a lot of money has to be allocated to the grassroots to excite people about the sport of curling, learn to curl for adults to get them intrigued. I find that when we do learn to curl here at the Western Golf and Country Club, that they start watching it on TV and therefore start watching it all over the place. So I think that it has to be an education. I remember growing up that my parents used to say that curling wasn't a very exciting game to watch. And I tend to agree on TV because they make it look so easy. And I find when people actually try the sport, then they get a better appreciation for it.
I find the interest is not there for amateur sport in general in this city, unless you mention something like the Olympic Games. And then all of a sudden, people are interested. Now, let's get to curling at Humber. And obviously, you know something about the sport. You've coached it for many years at the national and international level. How did you get to coach? I'm curious.
Okay.
At the Austrian and the Dutch teams, for instance. I mean, I thought Austria was known for Wiener Schnitzel more than curling.
Good point. It was just interesting the way that happened. Austria actually did well, very well one year at their European Championships. They, over in Europe, they have sort of like a major league and a minor league. So the majors are the A hall and the minors are the B hall. And Austria did very well in the B, which means that they graduated to the major leagues or the A hall.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided that they needed a coach to help them with this level of play. So they contacted Jim Waite, who is the national coach for Canada now. He goes to the Olympics, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually work for Jim at all the junior curling camps, the Amethyst and Trillium curling camps here in Toronto, in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim recommended me and put me in touch with the Austrian Curling Association.
So now you got this.
That happened.
Now you got this big gig at Humber College. What's going to be the biggest challenge for you to get curlers out?
It's the awareness factor. I do have the in with the junior curling camp. So I was Jim Bialak, who is at Humber, gave me a whole bunch of promotional material along with Doug Fox, who's the athletic director, and I took it to the junior curling camps. And so I did a presentation on Humber, and I think it's an awareness thing.
Is there more interest among young people? Is it more by women or by men for curling?
Good question. I think it's 50-50.
All right. We got this rich history in this country, but, I mean, do athletes have the same kind of pride playing the sport of curling as they do in hockey or football or some of the others?
The curlers have it. I don't think the awareness in the country is there. I mean, we are a hockey culture. So we say that curling is the other ice sport, the better ice sport.
Someone tells me that way back before I was born, and that's way back, like in 1968, Humber won the, I'm kidding, Humber won the women's OCAA curling championship, and then they won the men's in 1986. Can the folks at Humber expect, with your knowledge, a champion just like that?
I think so. I absolutely believe that. The athletes that I have right now are very, very dedicated. And we're out every Sunday afternoon practicing. The one great thing with the Humber program is that they are all members of the Western Golf and Country Club. So they have access to the ice just as a member would.
Right.
So they also play in the leagues with the other existing Western members. So they get a weekly game of which I come and sit behind the glass, and then we discuss it afterwards. Plus, then we work on it on Sundays. So they're a young team. They're very together. Like they're very, very close. And
well, good luck.
Yeah,
you're going to need it. Good luck with the curlers at Humber College. And I know February 16th in Sault Ste. Marie, it's the Ontario Curling Championship. Then in mid-March, off to Peterborough for the national finals.
That's correct.
Hopefully Humber will be there, and thanks to you for your time this morning.
Thanks so much, David.
Cindy Bishop, the head coach of the curling team at Humber College here in Toronto. We're going to go from that sport to wrestling, and I remember our next guest a long time ago as a teenager at the age of 16 making the national wrestling team, an athlete of the year at his high school in Milton. And yesterday, Kevin Owasa-Madge was in London at the last tune-up before the Ontario University Finals, which are set for February the 10th in Hamilton. He's joining us now, where he's in his fourth year of studies at the University of Guelph. Kevin, good morning, sir.
Hey.
You've achieved some marvelous success on the wrestling mat, but you've had to pay a price, too. A lot of injuries, two hip surgeries. Now you've got a herniated disc in the neck. It must be tough to get the physical side of your body ready with the mental side when it comes to wrestling. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, and, you know, I think the biggest part about that is when you get physically injured, you have to take time away from the sport, and then that affects the mental aspect.
Have you ever said to yourself, or even maybe your parents, winking the message that it's time to pack it in, or have you gone the other way, full scale ahead?
I probably had moments, especially with my neck, you know, around a year ago when I first herniated it. Just like I was in a lot of pain. I was on a lot of painkillers, like Percocets, for extended periods of time. And, you know, like there's moments where, I wasn't really sure if I would be able to return to the sport just because of, the level of the injury.
How'd you do yesterday in London?
I did okay. I got second.
Were you disappointed? I mean, everybody likes to go out there, win the gold medal, come in first. It's a prep for the provincial championship. Or was you're sort of playing your time here?
I'm not that upset with the second as much as I am with how I lost the match. Because, you know, in the end, it doesn't really matter how you do it, you know, this London tournament. it matters how you do it, the OUs, the CIs.
Absolutely. You were 14th at the World Junior Wrestling Championships in Turkey. Now, a lot of people will say 14th, but it was the highest placing by a Canadian. And some people will say great, and some are going to say not good enough. What do you have to say about it?
I think that it was a good experience. I think we had a lot of bad draws as a team there. It's tough when you go into a tournament and you draw a country like Russia and you have no control over that, you know, and then maybe you lose one match and you're out. So I was lucky enough to have a good first match that I could win, and then it put me higher up in the rankings.
Something I learned watching wrestling, and not many people realize it, or maybe even understand it, is that it's not always on the offense. That defense plays a very important role, a huge role in the amateur sport of wrestling. Can you speak about how your success has benefited from the defensive side of the game?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was in high school especially, I was very offensive. I would, attack. And what you learn when you get a little older is that people have very good defense. And then if you're attacking and you're a little sloppy with that, they're going to score because their defense is so good. So they're going to be counter-offensive. And you have to learn that aspect of the sport. It's you know, a whole, it's about 50% of the sport, right? It's just as much as the offense. So
right,
it's something that you have to learn if you want to excel in this sport.
We're talking with Kevin Owasa-Madge, a fourth-year student at the University of Guelph. He's from Milton and one of the top wrestlers for his age bracket in this country. At University of Guelph, you mentioned that in wrestling, it surprises a lot of people, including the folks down the highway at Brock. You won the Ontario University men's title last year. What about this season? What do you think?
I think we're looking to win it again. We have a pretty strong team. We're also looking at a better CIS performance as well.
One more quick question before we wrap this up, Kevin. In the off season, likely for you it's the summer, I understand that you do a lot of physical work, a lot of landscaping work, and I'm not talking about picking weeds. It's a lot of this, as I said, the heavy-duty building of patios and stuff like that. Is that something that would strengthen your body, or does that concern you that there is potential for pulling muscles and injuries as well?
I think there's probably a little bit of a potential, like any physical work, but it's a summer job. You know, at this point in your life, you should, you know, unless you're very lucky, you probably need to get a summer job. So
I know some guys who do some strange things, like pull school buses around a track meet, or they lift sofas to strengthen their muscles. But you just keep doing what you do best. Good luck to you. The OUA Championship coming up, and we thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin Owasa-Madge, a wrestler with the University of Guelph, and when he's not on the competitive mat, he's studying nutrition. Very talented, and one day, hopefully, his dream will come true and compete for this country at the Olympic Games. We got to close out this segment and make way for a sports update. Sunday Morning continues with me, David Grossman. Stay with us on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's time to hear about the superstars of tomorrow. It's Sunday Morning with David Grossman. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's a beautiful day.
And it certainly is. It's not snowing. It's got to be a beautiful day. Sunday Morning, David Grossman with you on this last Sunday in January. Can you believe that already? It's Oprah Winfrey's birthday, in case you're wondering. How old is she, 90? All right, I'll be nice. 57. It's also Dominic Hasek's birthday and Doug Risebrand. If it's yours, all the best to you. And if you get a moment, email me a piece of your birthday cake. That'll go well this morning with breakfast. Nice note comes my way from Alex Frescura, a teacher and a coach at St. Michael's College. And those in the public high schools are just so jealous of the private schools. And they should be, because they do a good job. And they know how to communicate as well. Anyway, Frescura tells me about a handful of players on his lacrosse team pulling in the big grades and going to university, and all of them south of the border. And one of them is Joe French. And he's going to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., one of the world's leading educational institutions. But he's not going until next year, 2013. And that's because he's going to benefit from a full scholarship because of his success in our national sport. Not hockey, but the other one, lacrosse. So Joe's thrilled, and his parents probably more so, because someone else is going to pay the school bill. And so is his grandfather. Very proud. Joe Powell, once a wide receiver with the Montreal Alouettes, catching passes from, remember the rifle, Sam Echeverry? Well, Joe's grandfather is at St. Michael's Hospital and likely checking out the nurses. And we also wish him a speedy recovery. But now we're going to talk to the younger one, Joe French. He's on the line with us. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Your grandfather, I think you call him Papa, right?
Yeah, Papa.
Of all the many things that he's taught you, including staring at nurses in hospitals, what's been number one for you?
I think number one is, you know, remember where you come from and remember to, you know, and all the things that you do to remember your family and the people that have that helped you got there. And I'm just so fortunate to have such a great role model and inspiration in my life. And, you know, I love you, Papa, and I know you're listening, and hopefully you'll get better in the summer. We'll be off to Finland together to watch that world championship.
For you, as 17 years old, 17, and you're already leaving home. Are you excited about that?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate for the opportunity. It's going to be a lot of fun and a lot of work, and it's a dream of mine. And it's just kind of surreal that it's all coming together and it's happening.
So you're going, if I understand this correctly, you're going to a prep school first.
Yeah, I've put my application into two prep schools, Deerfield Academy in Boston, you know, near in the Boston area, and the Salisbury School in Connecticut.
Oh, so that's going to cost your parents a couple of coins, right?
Well, hopefully not. We're going to hopefully see if we can, get some financial aid and work that all out. But they're two great institutions with two great teams and a great tradition. So hopefully I can find myself on one of those rosters next year.
Well, it prompts the question from probably a lot of listeners, including myself, and that is, if you're going to Georgetown University, why are you waiting a year? Why not right away?
Well, I had the opportunity to go to Georgetown in 2012 and 2013, as I did with a lot of schools that I was being recruited with, which is a great opportunity. And again, I'm really fortunate for that. For my family and for myself, the timing was better to be a 2013. I'm a late birthday, so I was born November 18th, which is sort of late. I was, you know, barely 17 going into the Team Canada tryouts, and going to university as, you know, 18-year-old freshman is pretty young. And graduating at 20 versus graduating at 21 isn't really a big deal. So I was in no hurry to get there, to be honest with you. I knew that taking the time would be good academically, but also athletically. And I figure if I'm going to give myself this shot at the NCAA and for lacrosse, my sport is the biggest show, you know, why not do it and prepare myself the best way I can?
Sounds like you got everything worked out.
You know what? I've had a lot of support and a lot of help talking about it with my family. And, you know, so far everything's working out the way it should.
Great years for you at St. Michael's College School here in Toronto. A lot of people knock you probably because they say, it's an all-boys school. What are you going to remember most about St. Mike's, the academics or the sports?
Well, you know what? St. Mike's has been really great to me. You know, it's a foundation that I can build off for a lot of things. I've been there since grade 7, so this is my 6th year. I've loved every single year, and it's scary how fast they've gone by. I think that the thing that I'll keep from St. Mike's, you know, going forward is the relationships that I have with my classmates. I'm very fortunate that the guys in my grade are incredible guys, and they're all talented, and they're all different areas, and, you know, the friendships and bonds that I built with them are pretty strong, and I got a good core of guys and friends that I can go to for anything. And that's what I think I'll take away from the school for the most part.
You play the attack position. You're number one for your age bracket in Canada. You led Team Canada in scoring the last Nationals. You made the National Under-19 team. You're the youngest one. And now you're going to the World Championships this summer in Finland. Are you excited about going there or playing or just checking out the scenery? And if you know what I mean, your grandfather knows what I mean. There's some nice scenery in Finland.
You know what? I couldn't be more excited. It's a huge honor to represent your country at any level in any sport or any event. And for that, I'm very gracious. I'm just going to work my hardest and try to do my best and see what I can do for Canada. You know, Finland's going to be a great place to play. The team's really excited. You know, they're doing a really great job preparing for this. They're building a new facility just for this world championship. And, you know, everything has been set. The stage has been set for us. And now all we got to do is put the work in, put the effort in and come back with gold, because that's the goal.
Your teammates, Andrew Mullen going to the University of Virginia, Todd Stewart's going to Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Justin DeMarchi to Denison University. Why is everybody leaving town?
You know what? Canada's great for a lot of reasons. And we have great universities and great institutions here. And, It's nothing against universities in Canada at all, because schools like Laurier, McGill, Western, Queens, they compete with the best schools anywhere. And it's not about that at all. It's just the level of lacrosse at the universities in the NCAA in the Division I is just so unmatched. It's such a high level of sport, and to have an opportunity to play at that level where you can play in front of 25,000 people at an NCAA quarterfinal or final, it just supersedes the idea of playing at a CIS school where it's still a varsity sport or a club sport where, you know, no one really comes out and watches and supports. I just think that guys want to play on the highest level and on the biggest stage, and that's what the NCAA provides them.
Nothing wrong with that, and we hope the bazillions at St. Mike's throw a party for you guys when you are deciding to go away. Good luck to you, Joe.
Yeah, thank you.
Joe French, a great lacrosse player at St. Michael's College, and hopefully when he goes to Washington, D.C. is going to say hello to the president, whoever that might be, when he gets down there. And we thank him as well for his time. We're going to move over to football. Big game coming up, and not just the Super Bowl. The United States plays the world, and it's happening in a few days in Texas. One of the players on the roster for the world team had a standout year, and I mean a standout year in high school at St. Andrews College in Aurora. I'll say he's got all kinds of choices for universities. We'll find out. He's tall, 6'5", great multi-sport athlete, but he hopes to be catching passes and a lot of them at the International Bowl on Wednesday. And he's joining us now from Austin, Texas. I'm talking about Jamal Kett. How you doing, Jamal?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. I know a lot of practice going on today as well. Fabulous high school year and a fabulous career at St. Andrews, for that matter. What's it been like the past couple of days in Texas?
They've been hard. We've been doing 2 days, so it's been tough on the body and stuff like that, but it's been good.
What was your reaction when you got the call, or maybe it was an email, or I don't know. Do you tell us, how did you find out that they invited you to be on the world team?
I actually got an email, and I was really excited because Eddie Meredith had the same opportunity last year, so I was really pumped to be able to play on this team.
Eddie Meredith is a former teammate at St. Andrews College. He's now at Boston College as well. Do you see this as more of, I guess, a pat on the back, Jamal, for what you've done? Or is this more of a show and tell for you, for universities and pro scouts to check out what's available for them in the future?
I think it's definitely the second one. It's a pretty big stage, and there's a lot of great players. So I feel like it'll be a good spot to compete, you know?
You mentioned before Eddie Meredith, big guy. Big. Like, yeah. He'd been getting hit by a Mack truck at Boston College. But in your case, there is also Boston and Dartmouth and Akron, and I think the University of British Columbia, just a handful of the many post-secondary institutions that are all interested in having you attend their school and also play for them. Do you have intentions of pursuing football or the other sport you do extremely well, and that is basketball, after you finish your education?
I definitely want to play football. Football is a spectacular team sport, and it's my first passion.
Are you thinking now, do you have it sort of down to a couple of colleges as to where you could end up? Do you want to share that with us?
No, I don't really know where I'm going to end up yet, so we're just playing it by ear right now.
Are you going to stay in Canada, or are you going to go south?
This weekend really decides, the game on the Wednesday really decides that.
This is the third annual International Bowl, and it features the United States under-19 national team, comprised of some of the top high school players in that country, against a world team of premier players 19 and under as well. And both teams are going to have rosters of over 50 players. The U.S. national team is selected by USA Football. The world team, for those who are interested, is selected by the International Federation of American Football. And what that means is that's comprised of 62 countries over 6 continents. Jamal Kett, what's it like working with young athletes your age from various countries who have learned the game in different ways?
It's actually a lot of fun. Like, we have a running back from Japan. We got receivers from Spain and stuff like that. And it's really neat just asking about the game in different countries. It's really good to see the sport growing.
I'm sorry I interrupted you here, but last I totaled it, and I may be wrong here, there were players on your team, the world team, from 20 different countries, 20 of them. Do you think that gives the USA the edge? Does that give the USA?
I'm not sure. We both have good athletes. We had a dinner yesterday, and the U.S. team was there, and there's a lot of big guys and stuff like that, but we got a lot of big guys too, so it's just going to come down to execution.
What is Jamal Kett hoping comes out of this game, other than just a great game for you, a lot of catches, a lot of people watching? What's something special that you hope will happen as a result of your performance?
Well, the best possible situation would be I end up getting a Division I scholarship. But if not, I'd be happy coming back to Canada and playing football, because there's tons of good schools there that I'd be happy to attend.
Is it too early for a young guy like you to start thinking about what your career is going to be like after you're finished university? Like, are you one of these kids that dreamed about playing in the pros, or are you going to take it one step at a time, maybe even play football in Europe?
I've definitely dreamed of playing in the pros ever since I was a little kid. But you can't play football forever, so I've definitely thought about the future and stuff like that and what I want to do after football is done.
What time of the year do you actually put the big push on training for yourself? Is it in the summer? Is it, is it a 12-month thing for you to be in tip-top shape?
Right when the off-season hits for football, then I'm back in the weight room lifting hard again. So in season, I don't lift as much, but now I'm back to lifting.
You're down in Austin, Texas right now. It's a great opportunity for you and the other players involved in this big game coming up on Wednesday. Do you sort of feel like a celebrity?
A little bit. They're treating us very well. IFAS is doing a great job just taking us out and stuff like that. So we're having a lot of fun.
All your teammates, coaches, and friends at St. Andrews and everybody back here in Canada are hoping the best for you, and we appreciate you taking time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Jamal Kett, a student at St. Andrews College in Aurora, bright young man, now a player for Team World in the International Bowl. That's set for Wednesday in Austin, Texas. What a wonderful opportunity. We're going to take a timeout and then come back with a story about a volleyball player. Get this, turned model. We'll fill you in on all that. Sunday morning with David Grossman on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's Sunday morning with David Grossman, Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
We're about 18 minutes before 9 o'clock, if that's easier for you. Welcome to Sunday morning on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. My name is David Grossman. You can follow me at GrossmanFan590, or you can email me at SundayMorning@fan590.com. Or you can listen to us anywhere you are in the world at www.fan590.com as well. Our next guest goes to George Brown College in Toronto, and he's studying event marketing. He's co-captain of a volleyball team that's also challenging for a playoff spot. And when all that is quiet, academics and volleyball, he models. That's right. He's a model. And you can catch some of his photos on the internet. There's a dandy of him wearing a pair of underwear and a volleyball. I think it's fabulous. Anyway, Mike DiCarlo is joining us this morning. Good guy. And good morning, Mike. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's get to the most important thing first. A game a few days ago,
you
suffered an injury, the pinky finger dislocated. And for people having their coffee this morning, this is an advisory. I mean, a warning ahead of time. The finger was pointing in an unusual direction, like sideways.
Definitely not a direction I'd want it to be in normally.
Yeah, and the pain, I can just imagine the pain. Like, for me, it would be calling 911. Tell us what happened, and did you still get to play?
Yeah, it was just in regular gameplay. I was up to block, and I was a little bit late, and timing for volleyball was more essential than just a point. It's, you know, everything with injuries, and you always got to be really careful. So being a little bit late, I wasn't able to get fully pressed across the net, and the swinger on the opposite side had a great swing, got a great piece of my right pinky finger, which is actually my hitting hand, and fully dislocated my pinky and was just below 90 degrees to the right.
Ouch.
Definitely not a good look, so I ended up playing out the rest of that point and tried to just play with one hand. It was a little bit interesting, and then looked over to my good friend and coach, Josh, and so I just asked for a quick sub out, ran off. We have amazing athletic therapists over at George Brown, so they're able just to do a quick extraction test, get it back in place, tape it up, and 3 points later, I was back in and playing.
And I hear you had a hell of a game after that.
Yeah, I think the adrenaline rush that I had after that kind of helped me play a little bit better, and I think I actually played a lot better after the injury, so maybe it wasn't the worst thing.
Now, Mike, for you, injuries are not new. I mean, I guess all this repetitive jumping from what you've shared with me and from what I've been able to read, the jumping up and down on the hardwood has taken its toll on a 21-year-old. Three knee surgeries and operations. The question, why do you still keep playing?
The love of the game is definitely what keeps me driving and all the way through. And I'm probably one of the most competitive people I know as well. And giving up is not ever something I'm ever willing to do. So want to keep going, and I'll strive to be the best no matter what.
Former Athlete of the Year, Winfield Junior School here in Toronto. Then you went on to York Mills Collegiate, then to Niagara College in Welland, and then modeling entered the picture somehow. How did that come about? Why don't you share that with us?
Yeah, it's definitely pretty interesting. I was actually at a volleyball game off in Niagara, and just after one of our games, I had a scout from one of the modeling agencies in Toronto approach me, and it was definitely a pretty big compliment. Wasn't something I had expected at any chance. And said that he thinks I'd be great in the industry and should come on out and talk to them. So there you go. The next week, after a quick chat with Mom, who definitely is the right-hand man in every decision I make that's really big in life, told me to go for it. And now I've been modeling with Ford Models in Toronto for 2 years and got to travel the world and lived in Milan for last year for quite a few months. So it was quite enjoyable.
Mike DiCarlo is joining a student at George Brown College here in Toronto, also a member of the men's volleyball team. What's it like wearing a $4,000 tailor-made Hugo Boss suit and posing in Milan, Italy?
That was probably one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had. And for that, it was actually for the magazine GQ Italia that was out there. And the experience I've had with that was unbelievable. The suit, having someone spend 6 hours tailor-making something just absolutely perfect and looking your best. It's something that every man or any man or woman, no matter what, would always want to be able to look your best. And feeling that way is definitely a pretty nice thing. So I couldn't complain in any way to be wearing clothing like that.
Now, are these, are these walking sessions? I'm trying to figure out if you're walking down an aisle like we see a lot of, the female models.
Yep.
Or is it just these pose sessions where they start snapping 4,000 pictures?
For that one, it was just a posed one. It was just for the magazine, so I actually had a 3-page spread in it, and it was for high fashion.
3-page spread, right?
Yeah.
Was there a staple and a belly button?
No, unfortunately not. I was a little bit near the back, but still happy to have it. And definitely really cool, and it was promoting just high fashion, and I was one of the most featured models in it, so I was really happy.
All right, as great as that was, tell us about what it was like wearing tights.
That's definitely one of my more interesting shots. That was just a creative, is what we call it. And that was with a Toronto photographer. And Toronto photographers always trying to contact models here and do a lot of free shoots with each other just to kind of build each other's books. So for me, if the more creative stuff I can do and put in my book, mm-hmm. the more chance I have to get a different job.
What about the one with underwear that's all over the internet?
Yeah, that one was a little bit more of a craving in Toronto. There's a lot of people that do like that, and the less clothing you have, the more you get paid, actually, so that was okay.
Did you ever think as a youngster that you'd be modeling?
I would never in my million years imagine it.
You know, when you look at this, modeling, volleyball, academics, you got to wonder as well if there's makeup. Did they do any makeup on you for these pictures?
For the most part, they try to have the guys look as natural and rough and tumble as possible, but I have to admit, it definitely does come across. For me, probably one in every 5 shoots, I do have just a quick touch-up just to make sure everything looks pretty good, especially if they're doing a lot of close-ups and they want it to be high fashion and really perfect looking. And something I wasn't totally comfortable with at first, but right now, whatever you want, as long as at the end of the day, I'm happy with the result.
You've been on TV and magazines, you're in commercials, you're on the internet as well. I understand that you can make a nice few dollars modeling, but not many people understand or know that the money that you've been making, a lot of it you've donated to the Canadian Association for Mental Health. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's so for me, CAMH or Association for Mental Health has been really, really important to me. I do have a couple
younger cousins that do have mental health disabilities, and they've been the most unbelievable little cousins and really wanted to support it. I believe it's something that's really underfunded in all the world, especially compared to the amount of sufferers that there are in the world and the funding that goes towards it. So I did have a chance actually in October to work for a big gala that raised $1.5 million towards it, which I was really happy for, really a step in the right direction. And I've been trying to do a lot of stuff my own, and I want to keep doing as much charity work towards it as possible and raise awareness and really try to raise the funding to make sure that it can be improved in the future.
Great role model. We appreciate your time. Congratulations and continued success, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Mike DiCarlo, student at Toronto's George Brown College, volleyball player and a model. We're going to move over to Ancaster, just outside Hamilton, and talk with a swimmer who's broken multiple records and set 38 national records, and hopes to be in London, England this summer for some big event. I think they call it the Olympics. Summer Mortimer is joining us. Summer, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. You know, I love the name, Summer Mortimer. It's here's the title for you, Summer for Summer.
I like it.
You like it?
It's very good, yeah.
And I'm talking about something happening in the summer, and that is the Paralympic Games. What are your chances of competing for Canada? I mean, in the land of the monarchy, do you think the chances are pretty good for you?
So far, I mean, there's 57 days till trials. The chances are looking great.
You're a graduate of Westmount Collegiate in Hamilton. Big plan. Right? Okay. Big plan was to swim in the Beijing Olympic Games, and that was a few years ago. You're a bit young, but you injured a knee. Can you pick up the story from there?
So basically, I've been involved in competitive trampoline, or I was when I was younger. I stopped it because of knee problems when I was around 12, and when I was practicing swimming, because I've been swimming my whole life as well, in 2008, training for Beijing trials, my coach had me doing some squats and, you know, exercises that I shouldn't be doing with my knees, and he knew that as well, but I did them anyways because he told me to. I ended up blowing up my my knee, and I was on crutches for 9 weeks, and that basically made trials not an optimal meet.
And now a date that you're going to remember for the rest of your life, and that is November the 27th, 2008. You were a trampolinist, a routine, supposed to land on sponge. Instead, you hit a cement corner. You broke both your feet. What went through your mind after all that?
Basically, when that happened, I mean, I wasn't expecting for that to happen, obviously. My coach should have been spotting me, but, you know, things happen. People don't expect accidents to occur. That's why they're accidents. When that happened, I knew as I was going down during my routine to land in the sponge pit, I didn't kick out. Athletes for trampoline have to kick out at, like, they say 12 o'clock in the air. So, like, right when your feet are over your body, it's when you're supposed to straighten out. I kicked out a bit late, which isn't an issue. Everyone does that. It's practice. But I knew because I kicked out late that I wasn't going to land the move properly. I had no clue whatsoever that I would land on the cement. I mean, obviously, things go through your mind. A truckload does, but the pain. First thing I did, I grabbed my knees and I counted to 10, trying to see if the pain would go away. And about 3, I couldn't even count anymore. The pain was ridiculous. I would never wish that upon anyone. I mean, everything I've gone through in my life, I mean, I thought, you know, hurting my knee was pretty bad until I did this. I mean, this is by far the worst thing I could ever think of doing to my body. I was concerned with, I had a competition 5 days later as my first competition of the season. When I realized I couldn't, you know, go and compete, that's when I broke down and got upset and, you know, saw my dad's face. And my mom and dad came down and, you know, my dad did not look impressed. And I thought, you know, things go through my mind. I thought that he was upset with me when really he was so upset with the injury he didn't know what to say.
You've been a number one swimmer for your age class for many years. Back in the pool again, what event do you specialize in, and what do you, I mean, what are the dreams here? What are the career plans for you in the pool?
Right now, my events are pretty broad. I can race pretty much anything I put my mind to. I'm world record holder in a couple of the events, so I specialize in the 50 free, the 100 free, the 100 back, 200 IM. We'll see how that one goes right now with training. Possibly the 100 fly and 100 breaststroke. It's really, you know, whatever I want to do after trials. I'm just trials, you know, you race it to keep the option open, and then you choose afterwards for London.
Swimming takes up a lot of time, training and training and training. And I understand also that you're an artist, murals and portraits, and you also have time to do some composing for piano. I got trouble finding out when you get time to eat. Like, how do you make all this stuff work?
I eat all the time. Eating is, you know, not an option. If I'm hungry, I eat while I'm driving. I eat while I paint. I eat all the time. Food is one of the necessities for me. You know, I'm not in school right now because of training, and training takes up majority of my time. But you know, when I go over to my parents' house and see my siblings, my piano is at their house, so I'll go and I'll play it while they're playing, you know, Wii or whatever. If I ever need to get my mind off of stuff, I pull out a canvas at my house and I paint while watching TV. Like, I always multitask.
Well, let's hope everything works out for you, and especially in the pool as well. And wherever you want to train, you can drop me an email. I'm also a swimmer, and I'll challenge you anytime in the pool.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you, and thank you very much for your time and for sharing your story. Summer Mortimer, a swimmer. Remember her name at the Olympics. The Paralympics is coming summer as well. Sports update is next. And then, hour number two, we're going to start with the author of a story, Invisible Injuries, Depression in Sport. It happens. Stick around. Sunday Morning continues with me, David Grossman, on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca.
We're back. Coffee break over. That's it. Back to work. 3 minutes after 9 o'clock. A little warmer than it was an hour ago. It's now -1 degree. Hour number two of Sunday Morning continues. My name is David Grossman. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. One of the three members of the Three Musketeers, and I say that with respect, Igor Enriquez, Dan Riccio, and myself put up the show together. And you can follow us on Twitter at GrossmanFan590.com, and a couple of tweets as well from Winter Warren, and he writes that disabled swimmer sends a sincere message. You're darn right she does. And there's also one from Jungle Man. Can't figure out how you find your stories, but they are very motivational. Thank you very much. And time for one more. Larry81, how about female models on your show? Right. Okay. We'll do that for maybe next week. Something called Equity. I hope your name is Larry. You can email me again at sunnymorning@fan590.com. You got some ideas, some suggestions, something you don't like or you do like, and we'll be happy to reply to you. Well, the topic, invisible injuries, two words, can become very serious. And here's what I mean. Great story by Alexander Leach, published in the current edition of Sweat Magazine, which is the official magazine of the Ontario Colleges Athletic Association. And it outlines how these injuries often lead to depression in sport. And there are parents and coaches and I guess all kinds of families who should be paying a little bit more attention to young athletes who are hiding or may not be aware of cases of depression that could be setting in. A lot of research went into the story. We're very pleased to have Alexander joining us this morning to talk about it and how he got the idea and the kind of reaction he's received from it. Alexander Leach joining us now. How are you doing? Good morning, Alex.
Doing all right. Yourself?
Very well, thank you. And a great story. I want to compliment you. I found it very, very interesting. How did you come up with the topic?
Well, I was tasked to write for the Sweat magazine, and I came up with depression because it's a topic that has always interested me personally. And we also had the Rick Rippian suicide, which was a large motivator for me looking into this story and pitching it.
What have you learned from this?
I've learned that there are the means and there are the faculties available for student athletes who have depression. These things are available. People are supportive. The coaches are supportive. They do exist. And if an athlete has depression, they are not alone.
A lot of go ahead.
And that actually surprised me.
A lot of people would say, you got to be kidding. I mean, young athletes don't get depressed. They go out there and they have fun. They participate. It's not in their vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is that they have to do that because there's no maneuverability when it comes to an athlete and depression, I find. From what I've seen, given how much you have to go through, like you've got the training, you've got the requirement to excel, the pressure to excel, you can't be just sitting at home curled up in a ball.
Was there something that you weren't aware of in your research and in talking to a lot of individuals when you're putting the words together for this story, something that you shook your head and said, wow, I didn't know that?
I was surprised that there was so much support for this and that this was actually being addressed. I was, because you always go into it with some form of expectation of what you're going to find. I didn't expect nearly as much readiness from the people I talked to, from the athletic therapists. And perhaps that's ignorance on my part, but I just did not expect that they actually had all this in place, that this was such a problem and they were addressing it.
Tell us a little bit about Alexander Leach. A student, are you, or a graduate?
I am an on-and-off student over the course of the years. I'm currently in the journalism program at Humber College. Before that, I went to Trent University and Brock University for English literature. I know completely on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to sports.
Did you have any personal experience when it comes to the subject of depression? I mean, were you an athlete once that suffered any form of depression?
I was never an athlete, but I do suffer from depression.
There are trends in society. There's obesity, attention disorders. Did you expect to see the amount of depression in amateur sport that you were able to find out?
I wasn't sure if I expected it, but I wasn't too surprised that there would be depression regarding injury or just the pressure to succeed, athlete stress. I wasn't too surprised to see that this would actually be an issue. I don't think that really contradicts how surprised I was that it was being addressed, but I was.
Joining us is Alexander Leach, who wrote an interesting story in the current edition of Sweat Magazine, the official publication of the Ontario College's Athletic Association. The title is Invisible Injuries, Depression in Sport, The Struggles the Athletes Face. And there's an interesting reference in your story to a female soccer player who suffered a brain injury. And there's a lot of discussion on concussions these days, that she couldn't go to school, couldn't play sports. She suffered from severe depression and isolation. What was that like talking with her?
It was very easy. She was very outgoing, extremely nice girl. I met her in the athletics complex at Humber through the administrators there. And it was very easy to talk to her. She was very forward, very talkative and very friendly. And to hear her talk about having depression is almost kind of surprising, but it was just how she was very open about it and didn't seem at all ashamed.
Were you able to find out, are there any statistics that show this happens more with the male or the female?
No, I'm trying to think back here on what I did. I didn't find any specific statistics on whether or not this was a male or female weighted. I don't think they'd. I personally would be surprised if they responded too far differently. But I can't give you any information, and I can't give you any.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, you quote a study looking at the story now from Athletic Insight, which is a sports psychology journal.
Mm-hmm.
And you're comparing sources of stress in college student athletes with non-athletes. And one person seemed to suggest that being injured, I mean, you jump in here if I'm wrong, but being injured and unable to play was a depression that showed the same stages of grief as death.
No, that is accurate to that. And it would be almost like death, I would think, to not be able to do the thing that you've been training for, that you've been pushing for a large period of time.
That's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think athletes and coaches understand depression is a serious thing?
I think that they are willing to help the athlete to get through. I think that for whatever reason, I don't think they're going to not support their athletes on that. I don't know if they actually are aware of how prevalent it can be, or if the athletes themselves are aware that the coaches are able to help them with this.
You know, I often wonder, Alexander, if schools need to build in psychological programs in the same to their tryout. You know, at the beginning, you know, you go out there and you try to be a member of the team and you blah, 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 and all that other stuff that goes on. Some of them are taught how to deal with people like myself. You wonder whether they should build in a segment when it comes to the psychological side of what happens if you win, what happens if you lose, if you don't make a team, if you get cut, rather than solely rely on strictly which person makes the team and going out there and recording the victories. What are your thoughts about that?
I think it would actually help with athlete performance to sort of have this body of psychological evaluation. It would help. It would certainly help out if an athlete suffers an injury or suffers a particular amount of setbacks. I think it would actually improve. I think it would actually improve playability and would improve player morale because they'd have these methodologies to deal with this.
From the people you spoke to, do you find that student athletes come forward when they are depressed?
I'm not. From what I got, I got the impression that a lot of them aren't coming forward. That they aren't sure if they'll be ostracized or not for this. Given what I've discussed with people as over the course of the article, they're not going to be ostracized. It's not going to be publicized. They're going to get the help they need, and they'll work through it in private without a bunch of people having to know.
Is there pressure? I mean, do you think there's pressure on the part of athletes, and for that matter, even coaches, to ignore injuries just so that they can stay in the game, be part of the team?
I think the pressure is there. I'm not convinced entirely that they are succumbing to it. I think the coaches in the end have the athletes' interests in mind over just simply winning. I think while the pressure is there to just force them through and get them to shape up, I think they will actually take the time to make sure that the athlete does get the help they need so they don't end up doing more damage in the long run.
You know, I've seen a lot of athletes participate, you name the sport, male, female, everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, how does one spot an athlete who may have depression? Is it that easy, or is it, as you said before, something they tend to keep within themselves?
Well, athletes are very active by nature and by what they're doing. So you would generally have them covering up their depression. I think it would be unless the athlete themselves are going to come forward, or unless something catastrophic happens like a meltdown, which nobody wants. You're not going to have an easy time looking for this. And I think that's one thing that they probably should investigate into is encouraging athletes to come forward early on, and trying to find methods of sort of locating depression without embarrassing the athlete.
Do you tend, let me ask you, are you going to do a follow-up on this 6 months down the line?
I'm not sure yet. That might be, someone in the Kurt Sweat run might actually beat me to it. But I would be interested in looking in following up on certain aspects. One thing I didn't actually do as part of it was clinical depression.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to actually look into whether or not antidepressants, like actual medicine, would be discouraged or even forbidden due to regulation. And I kind of regret I never
in the current edition of Sweat Magazine. Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
A suggestion as well. Any signs of depression, athletes, get some help. Nothing wrong with asking for assistance. It's better to be safe than to be sorry. When we come back, Canada's sending a team to the World Under 20 Ball Hockey Championships in June in the Czech Republic. And the Canadian Armed Forces, that's right, the Canadian Armed Forces, along with others, are going to be happy with what takes place. We'll tell you more. Stay with us. Sunday morning with David Grossman. We're going to take a short time out. Then we'll come back on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
He's our big man on campus. Sunday morning with David Grossman. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sunday morning on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. That's who we are. David Grossman's my name. And a follow-up to our last guest. You can get a copy of Sweat Magazine by calling the Ontario Colleges Athletic Association in Toronto. A lot of great stories. To be honest, and that's what I am, I didn't know much about ball hockey or a Canadian association that is related to it, or that, for that matter, there was even a world championship. I just thought that ball hockey is what the guys do, you know, at the schoolyard. You bring out the sticks, and we all pretend we're NHL players. It's something forever. Or it turns out that ball hockey, it is big in this country, but kids in some parts of this country can't play on their own streets. And that's a story for another day because of bylaws, et cetera. It was fun. You go out and play a little bit of game hockey in a weekend. Well, apparently that you can't do that now, which is unfortunate. Joining us to talk about ball hockey, the High Performance Director for the Canadian Ball Hockey Association. Very pleased to have Steve Dougherty joining us. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How are you today?
Very well, thanks. And I understand for you it is early morning. You're in Walnut Creek, California.
Yes, someone's got to live with the good weather.
I was just going to ask you, is it business or pleasure?
It's business.
Where is Walnut Creek?
It's East Bay, so it is probably around 20, 30 minutes just outside of San Francisco.
All right, I want to make you feel good. It's a balmy, nice day here in Toronto, so you're not missing much.
Well, I guess it means, what does balmy mean?
What's the weather like out there?
Well, it's up around 15 degrees during the day.
Oh, is that Celsius?
That's Celsius. I'm still going with the Canadian version here.
All right, 30, mid-60s, something around there. Ball hockey, a recreational sport, or, Steve, is it a serious sport?
Well, it is actually at both levels. The entry into ball hockey, there's associations that are set up throughout Canada now, and it certainly is a growing sport. And as these players and the associations grow, they put together provincial championships, Western Cup championships, and it now goes into the nationals and into the world. So the entry is purely for recreational, but as your skill sets develop, it gets very competitive. And there's players that align themselves with the sport more so than ice hockey now.
You know, there's a perception, and it's obviously a wrong perception, that ball hockey is something that little kids play, and that's it.
Yeah, that is wrong. Certainly, there's within Canada, we've got, let's see, probably around 50,000 members right now in the Canadian Ball Hockey Federation or Association, I should say, and of that, it's split 50-50 between the adults and the minors. And so it's something that's highly organized. It's essentially ice hockey. You take the ice out of the arena and you run instead of skate. And what's interesting, we'll have a number of elite ice hockey players, you know, players that play in the W or the O, and they'll come in and play and thinking that it's going to be a step down for them. And in short order, they realize just how hard the sport is, because as soon as you stop gliding, when you're running, essentially you stop. So it's physically demanding.
Canada's sending a team to the World Under 20 Championships in the Czech Republic, and that's this coming June. I'm going to assume this is a big sport, ball hockey, around the world as well. Is there a possibility of a Canada versus a Russia final?
Well, Russia at this point is not in the tournament. The countries that really embrace the sport are Czech Republic, Slovakia, Austria, Germany. Those are mainstays, with the Slovaks and the Czechs being powerhouses. But I will say they're powerhouses right behind Canada. We historically take the gold medal, or certainly compete for gold medal year in, year out. And this June we've got three teams going: the under 20s, the under 18s, and the under 16s. And for the first time, all three teams will be traveling to the same country. Around the same time frame, the tournaments overlap a little bit, but it's quite exciting. It's a big step for the sport.
Steve Dougherty is joining us. He's the High Performance Director for the Canadian Ball Hockey Association. And the Canadian version of this sport started, I guess, in the 60s in Toronto, in a place that I used to visit quite a bit called Habitat Arena, but that was for ice hockey. They hosted a summer program in late, I think it was 1969, and some people speculate that that may have even started the year before in the east end of the city of Toronto. But the oldest, I guess, continuously run league is the Mississauga Ball Hockey Association, which started in 19. Surprised at how this sport is hooked on a lot of people from coast to coast to coast?
No, it's quite interesting. I was involved, started being involved about 15, 16 years ago. And really it was just to get my son doing something in the summer that was related to hockey. And it's really interesting when you see the development of the skill sets, the hand-eye coordination, you know, it's ball handling skills as opposed to ice handling skills, but it is something that you can transfer from the floor to the ice. So it's grown quite a bit. People do get hooked into it. It's something where you talk to ice hockey players that are involved in the sport, and they have equal enjoyment going into the summer to play ball hockey, so that the leagues are growing. For example, with the OFSA, the Ontario tournaments for the high school, it started up about 7 years ago. A gentleman by the name of Mauro Caccini, who runs the Ontario ball hockey system, he started the OFSA program with, I think it was around 4 or 6 teams, and now there's 750 players that are involved in that on an annual basis.
But that's I have to jump in. That's not a provincial championship, because that organization doesn't look at ball hockey as being one of their major sports, at least not according to their website. Something I noticed, Steve, that, and I hope you can speak to this as well, and that is, the uniforms that these Canadian kids are going to be wearing, or one of the Canadian uniforms, is a camouflage color to honor the Canadian Armed Forces. And it's going to be worn during the exhibition games, I understand, also maybe warm-ups as well. Who thought of that idea? I mean, like, who came up with it? And what kind of reaction are you getting?
Well, that was something, again, that Mauro Caccini came up with. Out of respect to our troops, it's something that's gone over with overwhelming support. We feel that it's important to educate the players as well, to give them a sense of pride with the Canadian flag and for those that are sacrificing for our country. So it's something that we feel is going to be extremely important as a mentorship type of role. But yeah, it's gone over big. It's been well received. It's very respectful. So strong support for that initiative.
Why is it, though, that you're only wearing it during the exhibition games and the warm-ups? Are you not allowed to wear it as an official uniform?
Well, it's a good question. It's one that historically you submit the colors for your country, which goes, we go with the red and the white when we play in the tournament. So we have our historical uniforms. Even over in Europe, there will be some exhibition games, and that's something that can be worn during those games. But as of this point right now, we'll be going with their traditional uniforms during the tournament.
I'm going to assume that all athletes wear helmets. Is there a concern on your part for that word that's popping up in the game of hockey and in other sports more and more, and that is concussions?
No, within ball hockey certainly has body contact. It's physical, but it does not have the body checking. So if you reverse direction into a player, that's a penalty. So it doesn't have that same hard impact environment that ice hockey has.
Why don't I'm curious, why don't we see ball hockey as a varsity sport played more and more in our schools, in our colleges, in our universities, bona fide leagues, rather than just see it as something that they consider to be intramural? You play it when the gym is empty, so to speak.
Well, the ball hockey with the CBHA is played within an ice hockey arena or an arena like an ice hockey arena. There are arenas that are specifically constructed for ball hockey. So the answer would be the availability of, you know, the proper format to play that in. So if it was a varsity sport, it would have to go into some, you know, regulations in terms of rink size and so mm-hmm. forth. So there's just not the rinks available.
How hard was it to select these Canadian teams competing in the World Championships this summer?
Well, there's a network of scouts that are set up across Canada, and there's some qualifying tournaments that allow players to be scouted. Certainly in the provincial tournaments, and then out west we have the Western Challenge Cup, which involves the elite teams from British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba's coming into that now. And so there's a scouting process there, and then every year there's the Nationals, where teams will put their best forward and compete for national title, and that's the premier scouting event. So it goes through a vetting process. There's interviews done with the players. We want to ensure that they have the right attributes both on and off the floor.
Is it, I guess when you have these leagues, when guys are playing, or girls for that matter, are playing ball hockey, and on that note, is there a league for girls?
Yes. Yeah, that's a growing part of the sport right now.
All right. When they play, are you noticing that it's ice hockey players that are also playing ball hockey? Or is it going the other way, ball hockey players that are going to play ice hockey? Is there a mixture?
There's definitely a mixture. There's those that just love the game of hockey, whether it's on ice or on the floor. But we do find that with ball hockey, if you have an individual that might not have the skating skills, that's not a negative in the ball hockey. You have to be able to run. Running is probably the most important part of it. It's there's a lot of running within the game. So for those that can't skate well, ball hockey becomes a great sport for them. For those that want to hone their skills, it is already a great sport, you know, for the ice hockey players. Mm-hmm. So we get a mixture of both.
Is there a league set up? It may not be under the auspices of your group, but is there a league set up for those who are disabled who want to play ball hockey?
No, not at this point. No, that's a good suggestion, but it's something that we'd certainly have to put forth to the board to figure out how to incorporate that.
Spectators, what kind are you getting for these games? Is it good? Is it average? Is it poor? In Toronto here, it's just absolutely dismal going out to an amateur game, be it a college, university, high school, and you're getting fleas showing up, particularly even on weekends.
Well, a lot of it's related to the age group. When you get the younger age groups, the tykes, the 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, that's when the arena's packed. The parents are very passionate, and it's a fun environment to be in. The older they get, and the less involvement there are from the parents, very much the same as ice hockey in that regard. When we go to the provincial tournaments, they're very well attended. So those are exciting tournaments to attend.
Steve Dougherty, High Performance Director for the Canadian Ball Hockey Association. Very much appreciate you joining us so early in the morning from California to talk about what's coming up this summer. Thanks again for your time.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Educated a little bit more on the sport of ball hockey and whether it's competitive or just playing to have some fun, keeping physically fit. I guess that's what it's all about. When we come back, a very special week I'm told, coming up in sport in the month of February. We'll tell you that and what it's for and a lot more with our next guest, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Association. Well, let me get it right here. The Coaching Association of Canada. That's the best way of putting it. Sunday Morning with David Grossman returns after a sports update on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's time for the Dean of College Sports. Attendance will be taken. It's Sunday Morning with David Grossman. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
We're back with the final segment of Sunday Morning. And before I forget, a huge thank you to a wonderful group of people for joining us this morning. Lots of sports, lots of interesting stories. And all the sports and all the athletes require coaching and good coaching and not some of the fake stuff. The people who think they know how to coach but are really a problem. We see it all the time. And the organization's looking or adapting all kinds of alternatives to teach people to coach. There should be one standard certificate, one diploma, one degree, call it what you want. And organizations, they need to clamp down on people who determine that coaching for them is nothing less than a win or a championship trophy. They're absolutely wrong. At the amateur level, coaching is a lot more than walking around with a trophy. And joining us now, someone who knows about the importance and the values and what is needed to be a coach. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Coaching Association of Canada. He's on the phone from Ottawa. John Bales joins us. Hi, John. Good morning.
Good morning, David. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You've been out on the Rideau? You've been skating?
Yes, it's. We've had some ups and downs with the weather. We had some rain, but it's got cold again, so hopefully the canal will be ready to go. And the All-Stars certainly enjoy it.
Yeah, there's some kind of a hockey event going on in the nation's capital.
There is, in fact, and the Stanley Cup went down the Rideau Canal, but not in the possession of the Ottawa Senators.
I wonder how many politicians are showing up because the media are there in storm.
Well, probably quite a few.
Yeah, it's a great time for them to shake hands and show off. John, people say coaching is the backbone to every athlete's success. Do you agree with that?
Totally. I think the coaches really are the ones that are giving the guidance and the leadership to athletes, especially at the younger level. When you get up to the very senior level, there is certainly a lot more independence of the athlete. But at the developmental levels, the athletes absolutely need the guidance of a qualified coach.
You know, there are so many times, and I'm sorry I have to say this, that I've bumped into athletes in various sports, predominantly male, who say that they don't need a coach, that they know everything. And some of them go as far as to say that they know more than coaches, and if it wasn't for them, the coaches wouldn't be enjoying the success that some of them do. I mean, how do you react to some kind of a comment like that?
Well, I think there's a few things. I mean, in some cases, the athletes don't know what they don't know. They may not have a big enough vision to really know how much further they could go under the guidance of a top-level coach. But at the same time, if an athlete has a poor experience with a coach because the coach isn't qualified, isn't giving the guidance that the athlete needs, then you can certainly appreciate the frustration that the athlete would be feeling.
Do you think coaching has improved at the amateur level? I mean, over the years, or are there some things that still worry you?
It's definitely improved. We've seen a lot of, there's a lot of indicators about the improved knowledge and skills of coaches, but there's still a long way to go, and part of it is inherent in the competitive nature of sport, even down at the grassroots level, that some coaches just can't put in perspective that competitive urge and, in fact, do what the younger children need at that level, which is far more developing the skills and developing the attitudes about competing than it is about actually winning. As you said in your intro, it isn't just about winning a trophy. It isn't really about that at all. That's really a means. That whole competitive nature is a means to really teach kids both sports skills and life skills.
Do you see any problems with, and then let me give you an example. Well, there's always the amateur coach that's going out there trying to impersonate the professional coach. Do you see something wrong with that?
Yeah, we're dealing with entirely different people. The professional athlete with, at that stage, 15 to 20 years of sport experience and the maturity of being an adult does not compare with the needs of a 6 to 14-year-old who really, you've got to be thinking about their self-esteem, about their physical development, about setting the foundation so that they can, in fact, progress if they wish to. If that's really where they're looking to go, they can progress to be a high-level athlete, or they can just get satisfaction and the benefits of participating in sport as a youngster.
John Bales is joining us. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the Coaching Association of Canada. He's joining us from Ottawa as well. I'm going to assume, John, that you have been a coach or may still be a coach. Do you have a memorable event that you can recall that you could share with us?
Well, there's some incidents, certainly, that highlight some of the problems that you're referring to. I've now got kids that are in their 20s, but I did coach them when they were younger kids. And in this one case, I wasn't coaching them. I was just the parent, the same as many of your listeners would be parents. And my son was playing youth basketball. He was 11 years old. He really enjoyed it, was really into it. But the coach, and again, he was an excellent coach. He had a good background in basketball, but had also got qualified. But as the season progressed, he got more and more competitive. You could see the competitive fires burning. And as we approached the playoffs, his attitude really changed. It just became real pressure. The need to win was over the top. And what was interesting is it mostly affected, he had his own kids on the team, and he treated his own kids in a very competitive way. He was better with the other kids on the team. But what that showed to me was this was a very good person, a very good dad, but in that competitive environment, he hadn't been able to keep it in perspective. So when we talk about the problems in over-competition in youth sport, it isn't that it's bad people out there. It's just that they haven't been able to really get that keep that perspective that what's most important for the children is that they really enjoy it and that they're learning the skills so they'll want to continue. And in this case, several of the kids said they didn't want to come back because it had got to be too negative an experience.
You know, John, I've seen coaches lose their mind on not only athletes, which is an embarrassment,
yes,
but also on officials. I mean, they just blow a gasket. They scream at an official who, for the most part, is probably about 20 or 25 years old. They chew at a player in public. They tell off a parent, and yet there is no penalty to reprimand that coach. I'm just wondering, should there be some kind of a series of consequences at the national level that sends a message, you go ballistic, you look like a moron, you don't coach anymore?
Yeah, there really should be. There are some people that just aren't suited to coach at that level. I mean, maybe some of those behaviors, when you get up to older ages, it's not that it's okay to scream at kids if they're 18. It's just that you treat an 18-year-old differently than a 9 or 10-year-old. And somebody that really is not effective working with young kids should be redirected either out of coaching or see if they could modify their behavior to work more effectively with older kids. There are guidelines and processes at the national level. There are codes of ethics, but the enforcement, the putting those to use, really has to come down to the club and the league level. It's not very feasible for a national body to intervene in every community across the country. It's really up to the local leagues and the local clubs.
But, John, there's also the word politics that gets in the way, and coaching is voluntary. I can't tell you how many times that word has been stuffed down my throat, particularly by teachers who use that to say, well, I'm a volunteer, and if it wasn't for me, there'd be no coaching, and therefore there'd be no team. And boards of education tend to back off and let them do their thing. And my question, I guess, is when players say things about others, other players, and the rivalries become somewhat hurtful and discriminatory in certain ways, why is it that some trash talk seems to be acceptable by some coaches? They just turn their back, and others just stand there and smile and do nothing about it. Shouldn't there be a national message, or for that matter, a series of messages in each province that tells coach there is a proper way to behave as a coach? You don't tolerate that.
I totally agree with you. I think some of those behaviors are very unacceptable. And the reason is that they're not helping the kids. I mean, what we've got to make sure is that the programs, and hence the leaders of the programs, are behaving in such a way that they are, in fact, helping the kids develop self-esteem and so on. So there are some guidelines. There is a national code of ethics within the National Coaching Certification Program.
But a lot of them don't follow it, and there's nobody there to enforce it as well.
That is the issue. How do we enforce that kind of behavior and remove people that are not behaving effectively?
But the system is fractured, and I see it all the time, and it's in the school system as well, mm-hmm. where it should be strong and solid. They get away with doing things. The athletic associations are completely out of whack. It's so politicized that it isn't even funny. People say the grassroots is where we need to start to make these changes. What about your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's right that if the experience isn't positive at that grassroots level, then essentially the athletes quit, or they develop the bad attitudes themselves. They mimic the adults, the coaches, and the parents with the trash talk, with the negative behaviors that are not helping either them or sport.
Look, don't get me wrong. There are a lot of very, very good coaches out there, people who I look and I admire for the time and the energy they take to help young people out.
Absolutely.
But what happens when coaches learn the fundamentals to be a great coach and then don't follow those same rules?
Or are in an environment where there's a lot of that negativism, it's pretty discouraging for the good coaches to continue when there's that negativism.
Yep.
So we absolutely do need to put more emphasis and more effort on improving that environment for young kids in sport, and it starts with the coaches. So there is a national initiative called Canadian Sport for Life and the Athlete Long-Term Development Program that is really trying to set the stage and develop the guidelines right from the beginning ages of sport. LTAD, long-term athlete development, is a very recognized process now.
I also understand, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, we're getting short on time. International Coaching Week is coming up February the 5th to the 11th of this year. Anything special that you could share with coaches listening right now, something that you would strongly recommend that they incorporate?
Well, I think the real message as certainly a starting point is to get certified within the National Coaching Certification Program. That sets the foundation and is a really important piece of becoming an effective coach.
NCCP, that's the way to go. We appreciate your time, John. Thank you very much for your opinions as well.
Okay, thank you.
John Bales, the Chief Executive Officer for the Coaching Association of Canada. Well, we're going to put this puppy to sleep now. Another show, and we thank not only our guests, but also you very much for listening. Comments are always appreciated at Sunday morning at fan590.com. And you can listen again on podcast and check my blog, both at www.fan590.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at GrossmanFan590. Always like to hear from you. Igor Enriquez, Dan Riccio on the production side this morning. Marvelous job, guys. Thank you. Enjoy your day. My name is David Grossman. We're back in 7 days. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan.